Chapter 26. Our lawyers handled the division of property in a single long-distance phone call. "Yep," I kept saying. "Whatever." Dante got the Vega, the Lazy Boy, our air conditioner, and the TV. I got a shipping carton addressed in Dante's handwriting to Dolores Davis, Certified Lunatic. Inside were my wadded-up clothes, Ma and Daddy's candlestick holder, my Grand Union Employee of the Month plaque, and that box marked insurance papers. He'd taken his Polaroids out, but sent back the swatch of Ma's painting, green wingtip against blue sky. I got that back. That was home. He'd put all my shoes in a plastic garbage bag, mistakenly including a pair of his own, brown wingtips coated with dust. With fanfare and satisfaction, I chucked them in the trash. Then, early next morning, listening to the rumble of the garbage truck on the other end of Pierce Street, I panicked and got out of bed, retrieved Dante's shoes from the can in my bare feet. Roberta said divorcing Dante was the right thing to do, that life was too short, but that I was stupid not to have held out for the Vega. "That car was just a piece of junk," I said. "There were rust holes you could put your hand through. The engine sounded like it had emphysema." "That ain't the point," she said, rapping the legs of her walker against the kitchen floor. "The point is wheels. It moved, didn't it?" She hated the thought of the Parkinson's disease grounding her and fought against it. She'd probably made the owner of Easterly Taxi a millionaire in the 2 years since the disease had gotten bad, she joked. She told me I needed to get out more, too. Engage outwardly, Dr. Shaw was always telling me. Sometimes Roberta's and Dr. Shaw's advice were remarkably similar. That first Friday night I got back to Easterly, Roberta and I took a cab to China Paradise for supper to celebrate my independence, she and I in the back seat and her aluminum walker riding up in front with the driver. "Here you go, Teddy, you goddamned robber," she laughed as she handed up her money. "Listen to my show on Sunday and I'll dedicate you a polka. Now get my boyfriend out of the front seat for me, will you?" After we ate, we crossed the street to a Mel Brooks film festival at the Wayfarer Movie Cafe. Roberta had never heard of Mel Brooks before, but her big laugh was full out and contagious. Between her and Mel Brooks, the whole room was whooping it up. "Here I am," I thought, "sitting in the dark with strangers, laughing out loud at cowboys farting around a campfire. My whole life has flopped, and I can still do this." Roberta's eyeglasses and walker glinted in the movie screen light. I reached over and touched her arm. In those days after I moved back, I raked and bagged leaves, washed storm windows, shampooed rugs, took 5-mile afternoon walks. I had the remains of Ma's painting framed at a fancy art shop for $45 and hung it on the stairway wall where my and Dante's wedding picture had been. A nice place. In the late afternoon, the sun coming through the front door window cast a ray, a kind of spotlight, right on it. In November, I got a part-time job at Bookbinder's gift and novelty shop. Mr. and Mrs. Bookbinder were Holocaust survivors, a scowling, gray-haired couple with thick accents that required me to make them repeat whatever they'd just asked. All day long, they heckled and jeckled each other and pointed out nitpicky little places I'd missed while dusting. That was my job, dusting, and watching out for shoplifters and stupid heads that might break something. They'd hired me for the holiday season, the day after Ronald Reagan was elected president. "Did you vote for the Peanut Man or the Ecta?" Mr. Bookbinder asked me during my job interview. "I'm sorry? The what?" "The Ecta. The Ecta, that schmuck from Hollywood." "Oh, well, Actually, I didn't get a chance to vote.
Smart thinking, he said. You're hired.
Joe Wisniewski over at the Pulaski Hall says to remind yous there's a meeting this Tuesday night at 7. They're electing officers, so get your dupkas over there, fellas, if you know what's good for you. Now here's Walt Skiba and the Vice Versa Band with Perk Up Polka. During the week, Roberta wore her jogging suit, but she liked to dress up for our Friday night China Paradise and a movie outings. Deck out, she called it. She wore a shiny rayon pantsuit and made her face up with orangey lipstick and iridescent eyeshadow. Her twitching hand sometimes gave her a crooked, clownish line or a lavender-dusted eyebrow. I was forever wanting to reach over my vegetarian lo mein and straighten that awful wig. It never occurred to Roberta to lower her voice in public or to check that she'd buttoned her blouse buttons correctly. They probably recognize my voice, she'd tell me whenever I made note that people were staring. Must be polka fans. Roberta rejected most of my attempts to be her nurse. No, she wouldn't give up smoking, no matter what the doctor or I said. No, she wouldn't let me cook her meals for her. The migraines and dizzy spells had nothing to do with her forgetting to eat once in a while. The only reason she let me do her laundry was because she had a hard time getting quarters into the slots down at the laundromat. She blamed the slots, not her shaking hands. I told her I'd be glad to walk over and help her with her bath and makeup. She said she'd appreciate it if she was an invalid, which she wasn't. I did manage to convince her to buy some curtains and let me strip the black paint off her front window. Sometimes she'd wave to me from across the street while we talked to each other on the phone. This was the signal I devised. One ring if it was an emergency. Two rings if she wanted company. She was forever mixing up the two, causing me to barrel over there breathless, taking her by surprise. "Loosen up," she'd say, sitting in a cloud of cigarette smoke. "Life's too short." The bookbinders nagged me to smile more at customers and to watch more closely the ones with big coat pockets. They were reluctant to teach me the register. It was my energy level that won them over. When I wasn't up front vacuuming or dusting the merchandise, I was out in the back assembling gift boxes or consolidating the stock. At the end of January inventory, Mr. Bookbinder finally smiled. He told me I could have a 15% discount on anything in the store. I was the first girl, he said, who'd gone 3 months without breaking anything. That was Walt Wojakowski and his accordiotones with Who Stole the Kishka? Now, Eddie Vudka down at the newsstand said he wants me to say hello to him over the air. So, hiya, Eddie. How they hangin'? One Sunday morning, while I was folding Roberta's laundry and listening to her program, a record ended and there was silence. I waited, frozen, her warm bedsheets in my hands. A bunch of public service announcements. The same polka she'd played before. The same recorded announcements again. Then she was back on. "You miss me, folks?" she asked her listeners. "I had to go in the back room and stir the galumpkies." But the cheeriness in her voice was fake. Behind it, I heard fear. It took her until midweek to finally admit to me what had happened. She'd gotten dizzy and passed out while her engineer was downstairs in the foyer talking to his girlfriend. She'd come to in a heap on the floor with a chair flipped over onto her. A fat medical manual in the library suggested fresh fruits and vegetables, supplements of B vitamins. She ate them like a cranky child. I began riding the cab with her to the station, pressing the controls and switches she pointed at with her jumping finger, sometimes guessing wrong. She insisted she could still do it all herself, that she was just letting me come along because she thought I should get out and have some fun instead of staying home with the laundry. I drew the line at working her cigarette lighter and looked away while she fumbled and swore, trying to bring the spark to life as happy accordion music turned on reel-to-reel tape behind her. Next half hour is brought to you by Dropo's Funeral Home. They're real nice people, the Dropos. They take their work serious. Next song goes out to Pete and Bunny Bitsievsky. Honeymoon in 43 years tomorrow. Ooh, Pete, you're aching kielbasa. In February of 1982, the Rhode Island Probate Court declared me the official owner of Grandma's house. And the following month, the state of Vermont sent me a registered letter saying they would dissolve my marriage if I signed the enclosed papers. Dante's smooth signature was already all over them. Roberta and I went that night to China Paradise to celebrate my freedom. But halfway through my island passion drink, I turned gloomy. "Dissolve," I mumbled. "Throw 4 years of your life in a glass of water and watch it fizz away like Alka-Seltzer." Roberta was picking something out of her teeth. She brushed away my remark with a flap of her wrist. "I say good riddance to that stick in the mud. Life's too short. What are you going to do with the money?" Between the settlement check and Grandma's savings account, I had gotten $3,100. "I don't know," I said. "I was thinking of getting one of those VCR things, or maybe one of those big-screen TVs. I shouldn't have let him have my old black-and-white set. I got that for a present before I even knew Dante." "You're a dumb bunny if you waste your bundle on that kind of junk. What you need is a car. Wheels." "I should just call up his parents' house and have them tell him I want that television back," I said. I couldn't really tell which percentage of me wanted the TV back, and which just wanted to see him again, to hear his voice. Sometimes, half asleep in bed, I still reached over for him. I wondered if I hadn't made up some of that selfishness of his. It wouldn't have been the first time I'd lied to myself, to say nothing of all the lies I'd told him. "What you should do is start car shopping," Roberta said. I sipped the last of the drink just as my second one arrived at the table. "Why? So I can spend the rest of my life being your chauffeur?" The Wayfarer was showing Body Heat that night. Woozy from rum, I sat sulking in the dark, watching William Hurt and Kathleen Turner enjoy all that sweaty sex. He'd been so good with me in bed at the beginning, so interested in what pleased me. I looked around at the silhouettes of other movie watchers, wondering how many of them had made love that week, how many of them would go home that night and make some more of it. Roberta slumped toward my shoulder, snoring, her mouth wide open. Dante's father sounded groggy on the phone when I called that night. He said they hadn't heard from Dante in a month or so, not since he started law school, but that he'd give him my message about the TV. I held off making a decision about the $3,100 and got a second part-time job instead. Weekend mornings at Gutwax's bakery. The busier the better, I reasoned. "What's good today?" people would ask me. "Everything," I'd answer, and mean it. Sometimes customers would time it just right, buy up muffins and donuts and breads that were still warm. "Ah," they'd sigh, feeling the warmth, the freshness right through their bags. Mrs. Gutwax loved her baked goods, her customers, her son Ronnie, and me. She told me she swung her feet out of bed and onto the floor each morning at 3 a.m., in the belief that the whole world would work right if people just tried being an inch and a half nicer to each other. She had loved her husband until the day he died, she told me, and she still loved him 9 years later. What she wanted more than anything in the whole wide world, what she prayed for every night, was that her Ronnie would find a good wife that loved him and took care of him. Sometimes in her dreams, she said, she played with future grandchildren. The second weekend I worked there, I suggested she brush our flaky crescent rolls with egg yolk and call them croissants instead. We sold out by mid-morning.
"You're a genius," Mrs. Gutwex said. "I'll have to just see that you don't get away."
"I don't believe in marriage, Mrs. Gutwex, if that's what that means." You could be as blunt as you wanted with Mrs. Gutwex and know she'd keep loving you anyway.
"Sure you believe in it," she told me.
"No, I don't. I was married almost 4 years. It was a big disaster."
He just wasn't the right one.
Ronnie Gutwex baked for his mother. He didn't talk much, but went around the back room smiling at everything he made, moving with a kind of plodding consistency that I began to regard as slow-motion choreography. Whenever he caught me watching, we both blushed. At 33, he was flabby and three-quarters bald. His main passion was the Boston Red Sox, his most prized possessions, the thick scrapbooks on the team he'd kept since his childhood, when his father took him regularly to Fenway Park.
"He's not retarded," Mrs. Gutwex whispered one afternoon while Ronnie was out back at the dumpster. "He's just a little slow, but he's sweet as sugar, Dolores, as sweet as his father was. Sweeter."
I made my decision. A big screen TV and one of those satellite dishes that pulled in hundreds of stations. I arranged to have it installed on the weekend Roberta was scheduled for tests at the hospital in Providence. It took three men a whole morning to get it bolted to Grandma's roof and rotating. Drivers and pedestrians on Pierce Street kept stopping to stare. I was lying back on the waterbed watching The Dukes of Hazzard, Beau and Luke Duke as big as a drive-in movie, when the phone rang. Twice. Roberta signaled she wanted to talk. Or lecture, more likely. I ignored it. It rang twice again. "I'm sick of that mobility speech of hers," I told myself. I had a perfect right to spend my divorce money any way I saw fit. Who had suffered through a life with Dante, her or me? The phone rang once. I turned down the volume and waited. If it was a real emergency, she'd call back. Out front. The walker thumped against the porch floor.
"What the hell is that astronaut thing on the roof?" she said.
"Just watch this," I said, aiming the remote control at the screen. I flashed past Hollywood Squares, otters swimming in a nature show, Hawaii 5-0 in Spanish. The screen took up half of one wall.
"How much did you waste on this junk?" Roberta said.
"Look, the Patty Duke show. I haven't seen this since high school. They're identical cousins, see? One's an egghead and the other..."
"Get this thing out of here. Get yourself that car."
Her whole face was contorted. Spit flew from her mouth as she yelled. "Shut up," I said. "Just get out of my house. Just leave me alone." She fell from the very top porch step. Her face was skinned and bleeding. Her skinny legs splayed both on and off the stairs beneath her. She lost consciousness just before the ambulance got there. The bookbinders huddled shoulder to shoulder and asked me if anything was wrong. "Not a thing," I said. "Why?"
"Because this whole store has dust," Mr. Bookbinder said. "Because the rug needs vacuuming."
"And she's pale," Mrs. Bookbinder reminded him.
"Don't forget about the pale part."
I'd stayed up half the night before, watching my big TV and thinking endlessly about Roberta's fall. How I might just as well have placed my hands on her back and shoved. How, if she had died, it would have been me who'd killed her. In the 16 days she'd been in the hospital, I'd sent her $2 $20 bouquets, but hadn't gotten up the guts to visit her. As the bookbinder stood there waiting for their explanation, a lie about terminal illness, a brain tumor growing inside my head, created itself, but I chased it away. The bookbinders were worriers. I was pretty sure they loved me whether I did the vacuuming or not. "Nothing's the matter," I said. "Really." All that afternoon, I dusted begrudgingly, haphazardly. Whenever customers walked to the counter, I ignored them, made them wait for Mr. or Mrs. Bookbinder to take their money and bag their crap. Life was just a pointless joke. The bookbinders had survived a death camp, only to end up in this claustrophobic little hole in the wall, selling rubber vomit and stuffed Smurfs and fuck the Ayatollah license plates. No wonder I felt like quitting. What was the point? Just before closing time, I backed into a display of Who Shot J.R. commemorative plates, sending them clattering and smashing to the floor with a sound as ugly as Roberta's fall. "That's it, Dolores," Mr. Bookbinder shouted. "I'm fed up." "So am I," I yelled back. "You two are the sorriest people I know. You're fired. You don't work here. I don't even know your face." "Nice way to treat a person who's got a brain tumor," I screamed. I celebrated my freedom from the bookbinders by buying a microwave oven and two goldfish, whom I named William Hurt and Kathleen Turner. I visited them in short bursts whenever I rushed away from the big screen TV to microwave myself a snack. I noticed this coincidence, that if I spread my palm a half inch or so from either the TV screen or the microwave, I could feel a low-grade static. I wondered vaguely if radiation molecules weren't bouncing off at me, if I wasn't poisoning myself slowly with all that television and speed-cooked food. I'd bought the goldfish impulsively, remembering a container of food flakes, but not a bowl. They lived in Grandma's kitchen sink, swimming contentedly enough so that, for a while, I half convinced myself I could love something without damaging it. Except I didn't love them. I loved Roberta, worried about her. Wondered if she hated me now. Her radio station replaced her with some oldies but goodies disc jockey canned out in Hollywood. I hadn't seen her in over a month. The hospital told me she'd been transferred to the Sunny Windows convalescent home. "Sure, I'd like you to work full-time," Mrs. Goodwax said, hugging me. "That makes you more like one of the family." I let her misread whatever she wanted to, look out whatever sunny window she pleased. All the next week, Mrs. Goodwax, B, she wanted me to start calling her, hummed and smiled, and invented a million errands that required her to put on her coat and leave me and her sweet son alone together. One afternoon, Ronnie stopped working and walked over to me while I was frosting an anniversary cake. He smiled his gummy smile and blushed. "What?" I said. "What is it, Ronnie?" "Who do you like better on the Red Sox, Jim Rice or Dewey Evans?" "I don't know," I shrugged. "Who do you like?" "Rice," he said. "Oh. My mother says I should kiss you. Can I?" I put down the icing knife and looked at him. Nodded. He rested his flowery hands against my cheeks and closed his eyes. He took a deep breath as if he were about to take a dive underwater. I analyzed the kiss objectively as it was going on, firm and fleshy, neither a pleasant experience nor an unpleasant one. He smiled when it was over. I smiled back. "Do you mind if I do it again?" he said. "Ronnie," I said, "I'm in no position to... I don't have any..." "Well, all right. Go ahead." This time, I kissed him back. I wasn't kissing Ronnie exactly. I was kissing the smell of cinnamon raisin bread in the oven, and that warm room with its creaky floorboards. And Mrs. Goodwax's dreams of grandchildren. Kissing him to show myself I could be tender, loving, no matter how I'd mistreated poor Roberta. Then I was kissing Dante, rubbing Dante's thigh. The kissing was as much a lie as my brain tumor, as much of a lie as my marriage had been. We kissed and kissed until Ronnie got an erection. Mrs. Goodwax still hadn't come back by the end of my shift. I wrote my resignation on an overring slip and left it in the register. I didn't answer the ringing telephone for 3 days. Whenever it started up, I lay back on the waterbed and aimed my remote control box. The Twilight Zone, Three's Company, Johnny Carson, MASH. I absorbed myself in whatever was in front of me. At the end of the summer, I got a letter from a woman I didn't know. A Jacqueline Price, my father's third wife. "Please forward," it said on the envelope, "addressed to me by way of Grandma." She was writing, she said, because she thought I had a right to know my father had died the week before, after a 6-month illness. When he'd gone into the hospital in February for an operation, they'd found so much cancer that they'd closed him right up again. It was his choice, not to get a hold of me until after the funeral, she explained. His wish to be cremated, to leave what he had to her children by a previous marriage. "He was a loving man," she wrote. Battlestar Galactica, Roller Derby, Joni Loves Chachi, Bewitched. What was scariest of all was the absence of grief. The way all day long his death kept slipping my mind in the midst of the shows I watched. Can I just let go of him? I had asked Dr. Shaw one time during therapy. I had let go. And now his death showed me the emptiness of my choice. "He was a loving man," his third wife wrote. Had she turned him into one? Had he been one all along? Who exactly had I missed? Sitting in front of the big TV, I had to close my eyes to picture Daddy. And when I did see him, he was sitting at the edge of our new pool on Bobolink Drive, laughing at something I'd said, some joke we shared. I cried then. And at first, I thought that was a good sign. Those tears made me human, made me a loving person after all. But that was a lie. The tears weren't for him. They were for myself. The unsuspecting girl swimming laps and thinking her father would stay forever, would be there as long as she needed him. I turned off the TV and sat in the uncomfortable quiet. "Daddy," I said. On Good Morning America the next morning, the new Miss America demonstrated how to make sour cream and banana pancakes. I copied down the steps and walked over to the superette for ingredients. They puffed up beautifully, exactly like the TV pancakes. I sat down at the kitchen table, poured syrup, cut my first bite. William and Kathleen swam circles in the sink. I'd let the dishes pile up since they'd arrived. I got up, left the pancakes uneaten, and went back to my TV. I kept the television going for the next 2 weeks, afraid that if I shut it off, it wouldn't come back on again. I slept on the waterbed instead of upstairs, in nervous naps and near comas, startling awake to "As the World Turns." That's incredible. Doctor Who. My lack of energy fascinated me. I'd sit for hours trying to convince myself to take a bath or pull up the shades. I felt like those people I'd seen on Donahue, the ones who floated above their own bodies in operating rooms, trying to decide whether to stay or go. "I'm fine, Mrs. Bookbinder. Really." I lied into the receiver, scanning the empty potato chip bags and soda cans the way she might have. I was down to my last $100. The goldfish water in the sink began to tint. My banana pancakes still sat on the kitchen table, sprouting whiskers of mold. Real mold. Not the kind I'd imagined at Gracewood when I'd lost all my weight. I was gaining again, unbuttoning the top button of my jeans, staying all day in my muumuu. Obesity had been part of my pattern of repression, Dr. Shaw taught me. Except now, I was getting fat without repressing a thing. What was I repressing? The fact that I couldn't even hold a job? That an old woman had depended on me and I'd practically shoved her down the stairs? I took the phone off the hook and threw mail away unopened. I began to look at daytime as an invasion of my privacy. The superette closed at 10 p.m., so I food shopped at the convenience store over on River Street. That neon-lit store never failed to surprise me when it emerged like a mirage from the middle of the night darkness. The clerk, a chubby red-haired man, never saw me floating toward him. Lulled, I suppose, by the hum of his various coolers and freezers, he'd startle and fling his dirty magazines beneath the counter each time I entered the store. He stood at attention while I browsed, then rang up my purchases, onion dip, Milky Ways, Ruffles, Pepsi. I watched him count change into a hand I willed not to shake. Though we never spoke, I began to suspect he had a crush on me, that he was courting me in his own shy way, enclosing little gifts in my paper bag, sale leaflets, matches, complimentary contest entry blanks. 1 week, he started including with my purchases pairs of cardboard glasses with red cellophane lenses. "See the Gill Woman in bloodthirsty 3D," each said along the side piece. "Watch your local listings." In what seemed like no time, I had collected a half dozen pairs. I began to wear them around the house, day and night. I imagined myself glowing radioactively from the inside out. I liked the way the glasses turned my vision infrared. Lights came on across the street at Roberta's. I put the phone back on the hook, kept my ear cocked for the honking of taxis. None came. She kept the curtains closed. Curtains I'd sewn for her, shut, now, against me. I wanted to call her, to offer an apology, offer help, to ask her for help, the way I had that long ago night when I'd walked across the street barefoot, knocked on her side door, and told her I'd been raped. "The fat girl's coming back again," I wanted to tell her now. "I think she may get me." But I didn't call. Couldn't. The Gill Woman turned up two Friday nights later on Channel 38. But the 3D effects were disappointing. The Gill Woman herself, a large-breasted woman in a scaly wetsuit and a 1950s hairdo, was part mermaid and part shark. A hurricane had disoriented her. She was being studied by scientists who had captured her but misunderstood her intentions. They kept her chained underwater in a pool and swam down daily to prod her with long poles, then marveled and cringed at what I saw as her perfectly justifiable anger. There was a knock on the front door. "Roberta." I figured I'd let her in if she wanted to come in. I wasn't that much of a cold fish. But I wasn't going to listen to one syllable about the way I was running my life. Not one word about TV or mobility. Except it wasn't Roberta. It was Dante. With my black and white TV. And some woman, A girl, really. Someone barely in her 20s.
I tried to call several times, he said. But the line was always busy. We were driving through. You wanted this?
I stood there, wishing I wasn't wearing the 3D glasses or the frayed Disneyland sweatshirt I'd bought on our cross-country trip. My hair was pulled back in an oily ponytail. My legs were hairy. Well, thanks, I said, when he put the set down just inside the foyer. See ya. I started to close the door on them.
Janice really has to use the bathroom.
His calling her by name somehow gave me permission to look. She had a frizzy, triangular hairstyle and reddish-black lipstick. She wore a T-shirt with the word innuendo stretched across her junior high school breasts and a pair of those stretchy lycra pants I had seen reborn women, former fatties, modeling on Richard Simmons that same morning. Top of the stairs, I said. Dante looked past me and at the screen.
Holy shit! Look at the size of that thing, he said.
He walked inside. He was wearing a rag wool sweater and matching rag wool socks. He seemed to have gotten more handsome. I hear you're going to law school, I said.
Yes, I am.
And I see you got yourself a perm.
Janice did it. She's a cosmetologist.
How old is she, anyway? He smiled patiently.
I don't really think that's a fair question.
Oh, sorry. By the way, you packed a pair of your shoes in one of those boxes you sent me, by mistake. Wingtips.
Oh, right, he said. I was looking for those. I could use them.
Yeah, I bet. Lawyer shoes. They're in the kitchen. I'll get them.
No, he said. Stay and watch your program. I'll get them.
They're on the floor in the closet. Way in back, I think. It wasn't until he was out there that I remembered the moldy pancakes, the goldfish in the sink, the stacks of unwashed dishes that sat balanced all over the counter and kitchen chairs. I closed my eyes tight to clamp off the tears. Upstairs, the toilet flushed, and then I heard her footsteps.
Oh, wow, she said. 3D?
I handed her a pair of glasses. There was some clatter in the kitchen. A commercial came on.
Watch out for Dante, I said.
He bites. She looked over at me, her reaction concealed behind the red cellophane lenses. Dante came back out. Each hand curled inside a shoe. His face looked pale.
Come on, babe, he said to her. Let's go.
Wait a sec. I just want to see if the sharks get this chick.
I said, let's get going.
She took off the glasses. Okay, she shrugged. No biggie. As she was getting in the car, Dante turned unexpectedly and walked back up the porch steps.
This whole house smells of body odor and dead fish, he said. Wash those dishes in there. Get yourself under control.
Mind your own business, I shouted.
Fuck off!
I watched him drive away in their apple green Le Car. Hers, I figured. Across the street, Roberta was at the window watching too. He'd wrapped my TV in an air pillow bunting. I sat back down, absent-mindedly popping the tiny balloons with my fingernail and watching the gill woman ooze blood from where they'd torn her. I looked up innuendo in the dictionary. A hint or insinuation, usually derogatory, it said. I thought his dead fish remark was some kind of sarcastic comment about the gill woman. But when I went out into the kitchen, I saw what he'd really meant. William and Kathleen were floating at the top of the sink, dead from their own muck. Roberta had lost weight. There was a pink scar on her forehead, and dried egg yolk on the collar of her sweatshirt jacket. "Don't stare at me like that. I'm not crazy," I shouted.
"Of course you're not. But we'll both be crazy unless you get us the hell out of here. Now, can I come inside before January gets here and my ass freezes and falls off?"
I started with the pancakes and cleaned all night, scouring, scraping, vacuuming, bathing. "I'm so sorry," I told the fish, when I finally got the courage to flush them down the toilet. "Honest to God, this is all my fault." In the morning, I snuck behind the superette with my black and white portable and threw it in their dumpster. Then I called the satellite dish company. They balked at a full refund, but I shouted them up to 75%. The car we bought, a gas-guzzling 67 Biscayne, had a steering wheel that shimmied wildly at speeds over 35, and an oil leak that tattooed the road wherever you parked. But it had, as well, a tape player and a trunk big enough to hold Roberta's collapsible wheelchair. "This car's climbed Pike's Peak," a peeling bumper sticker claimed. I found the unlabeled tapes one afternoon while searching for the seat adjustment lever. The three of them, 8 tracks, were stuffed underneath the driver's seat amidst the beer bottles and rolling papers and fast-food styrofoam stacked in an odd-shaped gray box that said, "Keep in a cool, dry place." I had saved the classified ad, but when I called to ask the former owner if he meant to give me the tapes too, all I got was that recorded operator, the one who tells you in her chilly voice that the person you wanted has disconnected and gotten away. I shoved one of the tapes in later that week, during one of Roberta's and my morning drives. I'd expected country music. The man who sold me the car had worn cowboy boots. But I knew immediately what they were. Nor was I surprised. They had followed me all my life. "Whales," I said. Roberta lit a cigarette.
"Humpbacks," she nodded.
"Heard 'em in person once. The Canuck beat the shit out of me and then took me on a ferry trip to Nova Scotia to say he was sorry," she chuckled softly. "Went on that trip with 2 black eyes, she said. Looked just like a raccoon."
We drove until I'd played each tape through twice, until our heads were filled with the laments of humpbacks.
"What do you suppose they're doing, Dolores?"
Roberta asked.
"Singing? Or crying?"
She moved into the house the next day. It wasn't until November of the following year, she'd had a good couple of months, that we attempted the trip up. We hadn't planned it. We'd just kept driving one sunny morning until Route 1 turned into Interstate 95. And then there was the Welcome to Maine sign. We got to Canada, Campobello Island, by mid-afternoon.
"Them humpbacks,"
an old man at the dock said.
"Nope. They head due south come September, early October. Missed 'em by a couple of months."
The drive back was long and hard. Our plans had been so spontaneous that we hadn't thought about Roberta's medication until halfway up there. "We just got too ambitious, that's all," I said. "You're all right. We can still have adventures, as long as we pace ourselves." But Roberta was snoring by then. I was talking to the rearview mirror.